Well, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. My name is Professor David Jamieson. I'm the head of the School of Physics here at the University of Melbourne. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to the second of our July lectures in physics for the important year of 2012. I'm not going to introduce the speaker tonight. I'm going to introduce my colleague, Associate Professor Elisabetta Barberio, who's going to introduce our speaker. But I just wanted to say a couple of things before I do that. It's a special week this week, not because we have yet another very important discovery, which you have all come to hear about, but because Q&A on Monday night, I don't know if anyone saw it, started with the question from the floor to the panel, how is it that large consortia of physicists from all over the world are able to work so effectively together that they can discover the Higgs boson, where our politicians can't? Now, unfortunately, I fell asleep and didn't hear the answer. Second of all, along with a number of my colleagues, we've been working on a decadal plan for physics in the nation of Australia. And I'm pleased to say one of the themes that came out over and over again in talking to the community of physicists, people who use physics, people who employ physicists, the general public who observes physics keenly, such as the present company, was that a significant area of excitement for the future of physics in Australia is the quest for new physics and new symmetries. And we've written that into the plan as a significant opportunity for the nation for the next 10 years. And tonight's lecture, I hope, will be a sign of the start and the health of that endeavour. But let me introduce Elisabetta. Elisabetta Barberio, my colleague in the School of Physics here at the University of Melbourne, is one of Australia's most highly connected international physicists. She is part of the ATLAS consortium that delivered the Higgs boson last week. She also is strongly engaged with the high energy physics program at KEK in Japan. She joined the school in 2004 after extensive experience with postdoctoral fellowships around the world. She has been educated in Italy and Germany after starting life in southern Italy, as you will soon tell. She is on the local organising committee of the International Conference in High Energy Physics, where she has a significant prominent role. She is a very successful supervisor of generations of PhD students who are now highly placed in physics and other service roles to our society within Australia and around the world. And she also chairs our Knowledge Exchange Committee that has oversight in the relationship between the School of Physics and the general community. So I'll now call upon Elisabetta to introduce tonight's speaker.
Elisabetta. Thank you. So it's a big pleasure for me tonight to introduce the speaker. I know Fabiola since many, many years. We are good friends and she's laughing. We are both Italian. And I'm really happy that Fabiola is here, especially in this moment. You must know that Fabiola, we are speaking about big collaboration, we are speaking about the LHC experiment with 3,000 physicists. Well, Fabiola is the spokesperson of the ATLAS collaboration, so she's the one that's overseen 3,000 physicists. So you need to ask her how 3,000 physicists can work together, maybe even more than 3,000. So, I'm really happy, and you should be happy too that she's here in this moment. You know the announcement that has been done last week. Fabiola was at CERN. She gave the seminar, and it was a big effort for her to come over here because it takes 24 hours. I do quite often back and forward. It's not easy. And most of you, if you go to in Europe, you know how long it takes. So I'm really, really happy. You must know also that Fabiola is not only the spokesperson of the ATLAS collaboration, but has also been nominated by The Guardian in the 100 most influential women. And I think it's quite an achievement. And there are only two physicists in this list. So I think it's fantastic. And I would like to introduce Fabiola. And so it's a big honor. She's a fantastic speaker. And I think it's best that she start her talks. Thanks.
Okay, good evening. Thanks a lot to Professor Jamieson and Elisabetta for this very nice introduction. I'm very pleased to be here today, because this is a very special moment for two reasons. I will say, first of all, because as you heard last week, the two main CERN experiments announced the observation of the Higgs boson. And second, because we are all here, many physicists from all over the world. We are here in Melbourne this week to attend the International Conference of High Energy Physics, which takes place every second year, and this time is here in Melbourne. And of course, this testifies also to the vigor and to the importance of the of this discipline in Australia. So before starting to talk about the Higgs boson, I would like to mention a bit briefly what CERN is, because of course this, the Large Hadron Collider, is the most powerful accelerator, is located at CERN, and it's there that the experiments have come to this nice discovery. So CERN is the largest particle physics laboratory in the world. It's a place where scientists from all over the world for more than 50 years have been doing fundamental research that has culminated in important discoveries, in Nobel Prizes. Second important point is that in order to achieve our physics goal, we have to develop cutting-edge technologies and a lot of innovation that we also transfer to society, to industry. One bright example is the World Wide Web, which was introduced at CERN in the 90s with the aim of facilitating the communication among the physicists of the laboratory, and then, of course, as you know, has changed the way society access the information. CERN is also a place where we train young people, school students, also teachers, but also tomorrow's scientists. And it's a fantastic place to bring the world together and nations together by attracting many scientists from all over the world to collaborate in high-level scientific projects. So CERN was founded in 1954 after the war. I think the reason was to, in some sense, to create a center of excellence for research in Europe after the war, and also to help foster a collaboration among nations at the moment where the Cold War was starting. So it had a twofold goal, one scientific and one a little bit social and political. Today, it consists of 20 member states. All of them are from Europe, but recently CERN has opened its door also to countries, non-European countries, and there are more and more nations from all over the world who manifest interest in joining CERN. Representatives of the member states, so the 20 countries, sit in the council, which is the highest body of the organization. CERN is an international organization like the UN, and Council has the highest authority in various matters, technical matter, administration, and an important also scientific decision. The budget is of the order of 1 billion Swiss francs, so 1 billion, say 1 billion Australian dollars, which corresponds to about a cup of coffee per European citizen. So it's not that much. And, well, good coffee, I would say, is not really, not the cheapest coffee, good coffee. And this budget is used in part to pay the salaries of the employees. CERN has 2,200 employees. And in part to develop and maintain the infrastructures. Infrastructure are the accelerators and all the other equipments and instrumentation that is used by the worldwide community to do experiments at CERN. So, and the worldwide community participating in CERN experiments consists today of more than 10,000 scientists from all over the world, from the member states in blue, from the observer states like India, like the US, UNESCO, etc., in green, and from other countries. Australia contributes with about 20 to 30 physicists, so it's part of this important Sorry, perhaps I should move to the other side. Not seeing the camera. So Australia is part of this important project, and I will show you more details later on. Okay, so let's now move to the main mission of CERN. CERN's primary mission is science. So what we do at CERN, we study the elementary particles, which are the building blocks of matter, and their interactions at the most fundamental level. So we all know today that matter is made of molecules. Molecules are made of atoms, and atoms are made of a central nucleus and a cloud of electrons. And the nucleus is made of neutrons and protons, and neutrons and protons are in turn made of very small particles called quarks. So as far as we know today, quarks and electrons are elementary particles. You can't just break them into smaller pieces because they are elementary with our present knowledge and capability of scrutinizing matter. And these elementary particles are the fundamental constituents of everything. So this laser pointer, myself, you, all of you, we are all made of quarks and electrons and empty space. This is what we are made of. Okay, these are our fundamental constituents. Now, experiments at high energy accelerator, like the Large Hadron Collider, allow us today to scrutinize matter down to a scale of less than 1 billionth of a billionth of a meter. So we are able to go down. Does it work? Yes. Where is it? Here. Go down here and to at the level of studying the individual quarks inside the proton and the neutron. At the same time, studying matters at the smaller scales allows us to understand the universe. So if you want, the infinitely small allows us to understand the very big and the infinitely big. And the reason is that that the universe at the moment where it was formed, about 14 billion years ago, was very, as you know, was very hot. And then with time, it expanded and it cooled down, and macrostructures started to appear, like atoms, then stars, galaxies, planets, etc. But at the beginning, it was something very hot and was governed by the laws of particle physics, essentially. So by studying particle physics and their interaction, we can understand what happened in the universe in the very first instance of its life. Okay, so what do we do in practice? Because this is very nice, but we have to find a way of doing this kind of study. So in practice, what we do, and this is a very simplified picture that you should not propagate outside this room because I could get fired if the CERN Director General gets to hear what I'm saying. But in a very simple picture, what we do, we accelerate two beams of particles, for instance, two beams of protons in two opposite directions, usually in a ring, as you can see in this cartoon. And then we make them collide. And in the collision, if you want, the protons breaks into thousands of pieces, like when you have two cars, and two Ferrari, you have imagine going at full speed and then colliding head on, and then of course they go into many pieces, so you can understand how these objects are made and study how they interact at high energy. But also, when you produce energy, according to Einstein equation, E=mc², you can transform this energy into matter, into new particles, and so you can create from the energy of the collision new particles, and the higher the energy of the collision, the heavier the particles that you can produce. And so some particles that have not been observed at the previous accelerators because they didn't have enough energy can become accessible today with the Large Hadron Collider because the energy is much higher. Okay? So then what we do, we surround the interaction region, the colliding region of the two beams with detectors, particle detectors. These are instruments made of different materials that are used to surround this region and to detect as many particles coming out of the collision as possible, ideally all of them, in practice not all of them, but most of them. And then by detecting these particles and measuring their energies, their trajectory, their type, their kind, we are able to reconstruct the collision event, and so understand what happened in the collision, what kind of phenomenon was involved in this kind of in the collision. So we essentially need three things. We need accelerators, we need detectors, and we need computers. These are the three things. Of course, we need one fourth element, which is the main one. We need brains. We need human brain and ingenuity to get this important, this very complex and very high-tech objects work, and also to extract the physics from the data. So accelerators are usually rings, underground rings. So you can see here an image of the elements of an accelerator. And they are made of two basic elements. So electric field to accelerate the beam of particles incrementally at each turn, and then magnetic field to bend these particles and to keep them inside the ring. And because they are the instruments that accelerate those particles and allow us with high energy to scrutinize the matter at a very fundamental level, they can be considered as giant microscopes. They have essentially the same function as a microscope that goes down deeper and deeper into matter. Detectors are massive instruments that surround the collision point and then allow us to detect ideally all the particles produced in the collision and track them one by one, measure their trajectory, measure their energy, recognize the type of particle. Is it an electron, a proton, a photon that has been produced in the collision? And finally, we need computers because we have an enormous amount of data that are produced by these instruments, and so we need to store them, we need to process them, we need to distribute them all over the world. And so we need also this third element. Now, the most powerful accelerator and the most high-tech and complex detector and the most advanced computing infrastructure ever achieved in accelerator-based particle physics, but I think more in general in science, have been conceived and developed and built in the context of the Large Hadron Collider, which is one of the most ambitious projects in science in general. It has required big efforts by the international community and to develop very innovative concepts and technologies in various fields, from cryogenics to electronics, data treatment and transfer, etc. And more than 20 years of work by the international scientific community in our field. First ideas were developed and were discussed in the early 80s, and operation started in November 2009. So what is DLHC? DLHC is a 27-kilometer ring, 100 meters below ground in the country at the border between Switzerland and France. So here we can see an aerial view of the region. This is Geneva's airport. This is third main site. These are the mountains of the Jura chain. The Lake Geneva is down here. And this little green dots show the border between France and Switzerland and France. And this ring here indicates the location of the 27-kilometer ring of the DLHC, which is, of course, not visible on the surface. It's underground, 100 meter underground. And so what we do now is started in end of 2009, but since March 2010, we accelerate two proton beams in two opposite directions up to very high energy, 3.5 tera electron volt per beam. I will try to quantify this in the next slide. This is the world record, and today we are operating even at higher energy, 4 TV per beam, which means 8 TV in the collision. And we smash them in 4 points here, where the 4 stars are located, where we have installed 4 big experiments in big underground caverns. And the experiments are shown here. They are underground, as I mentioned, ATLAS, CMS, LHCb, and ALICE. ATLAS and CMS are the two biggest experiments. They are a so-called general purpose experiment. That is, they are able to study all aspects of the collisions, whereas ALICE and LHCb are dedicated to some specific goals. I will not go into details. I can answer to question. Now, Australia is a partner of ATLAS. They are very deeply involved, very much involved in the ATLAS experiment, and I will come back to their contribution later on. So I said that we need three things. We need accelerators, detectors, and a computer. So I will start with the accelerator. DLHC is an unprecedented accelerator. It's running at a much higher energy than its predecessor. As I mentioned before, 4 TeV per particle beam. And in a couple of years from now, we will essentially almost double the energy. So this energy, 8 tera-electron-volt in the center of mass in the collision, it's a huge amount of energy at the microscopic level. To give you an idea, it can be compared to something like 100,000 billion the temperature times the billion times of, 10 to the 14 times the temperature in this room. So it's a very, very huge amount of energy. However, it's concentrated in a very small region. Okay, on a macroscopic scale, it's a very small amount of energy. It's at the level of 1 microjoule, so it would be enough, just enough to, you know, to swat a mosquito. What is most challenging in the LHC and in a proton accelerator is not to accelerate particles. This is relatively easy. What is difficult is to keep the particles inside the ring. It's like when you drive a car. If the car has a very high speed, it's very difficult to bend it and to keep it in a ring. Okay. So what is difficult is to bend the beams, and to bend the beams we use magnets. And in order to bend the high energy beams of the LHC, we had to conceive and develop and build magnets that are unprecedented in terms of performance, in terms of the magnetic field they can produce. We need something like 1,200 magnets to bend these beams, and you can see them here in the underground tunnel of the LHC. You see these blue objects. These are the magnets. These are superconducting magnets, because to achieve the high current needed to achieve, in turn, the very high magnetic field, they have to work at very low temperature. They have to provide currents without any resistance, so they have to be superconducting objects. They have to work very close to the absolute zero. Actually, they work at 2 Kelvin. 2 Kelvin is at minus 270 degrees, so it's at 2 degrees from the absolute zero, and they are made of 7,600 kilometers of niobium titanium superconducting cable. So they are really a kind of jewel of the technology, and today they are still the highest current magnets that people can build on an industrial level, that is at the level of 1,200 magnets filling almost completely 27 kilometer ring. Of course, there are prototypes, small single prototypes that can go higher, but not at the level of filling a full accelerator. The second element are detectors. So here you can see a cut into the CMS detector, one of the two big experiments. So you have to imagine that here the beam is perpendicular to the screen, one going inward, the other one outward. And what you can see here is just a wedge of this detector. You see it's made of several layers built with different materials, many cases high-tech instruments, silicon, scintillator, liquid argon in the case of the ATLAS experiment, etc. And you can see that what the function of these various layers is to be able to measure the trajectory of the particles producing the collision and also to distinguish them. So, for instance, this object is a photon, this other object is an electron, because the information, combining information coming from the various layers, we can, putting together this information, we can understand what kind of particle has been produced. So as for the accelerator, also for the detector, the LHC detectors require jumps and big leaps forwards in terms of concept and technologies. First of all, about the size, concerning the size and the complexity. So this is ATLAS. is a 47 meter, 45 meter long detector, 25 meter high. So if this number doesn't tell you much, you can compare with the size of a human being, lady or gentleman here. You can see that it's really an enormous detector. Why so big? Because in a collision, we are producing particles of very high energy, and to absorb and to measure high energy particles, you need big volumes. You cannot just measure a very high energy particle in just a few centimeters. These detectors have to be extremely fast because the two proton beams interact in the middle of the detectors, typically 40 million times per second. So they have to, it's like giant camera taking pictures of the collision, but this camera is taking, well, at least considering 40 million interactions per second. And they are extremely complex because they contain a huge number of individual sensitive elements, because we want to measure the trajectories of the particle with a micrometric precision. 1 micron is 10 to the minus 6 meters, so 1 millionth of a meter. And so in order to be able to track every single particle with this precision, you need to have very little sensitive elements. So they are very big, but they contain a huge number of sensitive elements, like, for instance, 100 millions of silicon channels. So they're extremely complex. Size and precision are two quite important features of this detector. So just to give you an idea of the complex infrastructure installation work we had to go through, this picture shows the Atlas underground cavern in June 2003, when the excavation work had finished, and so the civil engineering team had handed over the cavern to us, to the experiments. You see it was essentially empty. And then we started to install the various pieces of the detector, starting with the feeds and then lowering big pieces. For instance, these pieces that you see here, there are 8 of them. These are very big superconducting magnets used to bend particles, and so to measure their momentum. These are 25 meters long and 100 ton each. So you see it's quite a complex object. And this is the detector at the very advanced stage of the installation, not completed, but almost. And again, you can see here a person. And you can see the size, spectacular size of this detector. So not only the detector and the accelerator are quite impressive in their complexity, in their size, but also the size and the spread of the scientists working in this project is quite remarkable. So as Elisabetta was mentioning before, Atlas consists of 3,000 scientists from all over the world, from 38 countries. So here you can see a map of Atlas in yellow, all the countries that are involved in our experiment, from all the continents. And in particular, you can see here a place that you know here. Pointer doesn't work here. Okay, fine. So Australia is involved in Atlas through three teams from Adelaide, Melbourne, and Sydney, and the university, for a total of about 30 scientists and 15 students. They are led by Professor here, Jeff Taylor, who is also the founder of a very important center of excellence in particle physics at the terascale that Australia has put in place, which is very successful and which is now creating a lot of building contacts with the international community. We have a very nice workshop in a couple of days with the Italian community. So it's really an important initiative. These 30 scientists have given a very strong contribution to Atlas, in particular in building one of the most high-tech components of Atlas. This is the silicon detector made of 6 million of high-tech silicon and silicon strips, now contributing in a very important way to the physics, but also working also on the upgrade of these detectors, because this detector will need to be upgraded soon, and so developing more and more cutting-edge technology, for instance, in the domain of silicon detector. And as I said at the beginning, the respect and the appreciation of the international community for the Australian contribution to our discipline are demonstrated by the fact that we are all here. So the full international community is here this week to meet and to discuss the status of our discipline at the moment. And we are very lucky to be here and very pleased to be here at a very exciting time that is, of course, related to the Expos. Before moving to physics, I would like to show you another interesting information, another interesting graph. So this plot shows the age distribution of the Atlas population, in blue for boys and in red for girls. And you can see that, first of all, the collaboration is extremely young. You see that out of these 3,000 physicists, more than 1,000 are PhD students. So more than one third of the collaboration is young, and actually they are the driving force of this experiment because they are extremely enthusiastic, determined, competent, and very serious. And you see actually that the peak of the distribution is below 30, 35. And you also see that the fraction of, well, women are typically 20%, 15 to 20% of the total, and you can see that there is a nice trend, that is there are more and more women among the young generation. So this is something that we have to watch. We will have to update this graph because it's not the most up-to-date one, but it's very nice to see this trend. So I don't have the time to discuss computing. I think I will postpone this to question, and I will now move to physics. Well, before moving to physics, I would like to remind you to give you some additional numbers. So we talk about this fantastic and high-tech superconducting magnets, 1,200. But in the full accelerator, in the full ring, there are many more. There are 10,000 magnets, of which 70,000 are superconducting. So the accelerator is really very busy and very full of different magnets. The two proton beams make 11,000 turns of the full 27-kilometer ring per second because they travel close to the speed of light. And as I mentioned before, they interact in the experimental region where the detector are located 40 million times per second. These beams are very small. At the moment of the interaction, their cross-section is 16 microns in size, so it's much smaller than a human hair, so they are very, very small. Also, the energy stored in the beams is very high. Today is at the level of 140 or 120 megajoule, but when the LHC will operate at full power, design power in terms of energy and intensity, the energy stored in the beam will be 350 megajoule. If you don't know what this is, I was said that this is like a British aircraft carrier traveling at 12 knots. It has to be British, I don't know why, but okay. This is what I don't want to contradict what people told me, but it has to be British. Anyway, as I mentioned before, these magnets work at very low temperature. They have to be superconducting, and the materials become superconducting at very low temperature, 1.9 Kelvin, and actually, this is cooler than outer space. Outer space is at 3 Kelvin, and we are at 1.9, so we are in the coolest part, or the coolest point of the universe, in all sense. Okay, so the question is why, of course. Why did we embark in such a challenging and difficult project and adventure? So the reason is that the elementary particles, of which I mentioned a few before, and their interactions are very well known today, thanks to almost 40 years of experimental work at accelerators, and not only at accelerators, that has allowed us to discover most of the particles that we know today and to measure their interaction. These elementary particles and their interactions are described by a theory which is called the Standard Model, a very successful theory that really predicted, even before we discovered actually the particles and interaction, the nature of these particles and their interactions. And all of the Standard Model, all of the particles predicted by the Standard Model have been found. Actually, until, if I had to give this talk 1 week ago, I would have said all of the particles but one. And today I can say all of the particles because now the exposon is there. So This seems to be quite satisfactory, and so we should say that we understand everything, and we should invest our money in other research fields, because the particle physics is well understood. And unfortunately, this is not the case, because there are several outstanding questions to which today we are not able to give an answer, we and the standard model. So, for instance, the first question is, what is the origin of the particle masses? This is actually the question related to the Higgs boson, so I will spend some time on this specific question tonight and not on the other, so I will just mention the other. What is the nature of dark matter? We know today, with a certain level of confidence and also some precision, that due to various missions, some NASA mission, for instance, that 25% of the universe is made of a form of matter that we don't know. That is, none of the particle that we know, so the particle predicted by the standard model we have observed so far, can explain the features of dark matter. And actually, we know only 5% of the universe. The rest is form of matter that what we know that we don't know, or a form of energy that we don't know. So only 5% of the universe is made of the matter that we know, the atoms, elements, etc. We also know that there is very little antimatter in the universe, and there is a lot of matter. Whereas at the beginning of everything, at the time of the Big Bang, matter and antimatter were the same level, we think. So what has created this imbalance, which fortunately is there, otherwise we would not be here. What is the history of the universe? Okay, so as I mentioned before, the higher the energy will produce, the more farther back in time we can go. Are there other forces in addition to the four forces that we know today? Are there other microscopic space dimensions, etc.? So DLHC was built to address this question that the standard model is not able to address. This means that this doesn't mean the standard model is wrong, because of course it describes the elementary particles and their forces as we have measured until now, and it works very well. It only means that it's not complete. That is, that most likely, for sure, I will say, is not the ultimate theory of particle physics, because the ultimate theory is a theory that is able to address all the questions. And so we are after this ultimate theory, or at least hints of it, with DLHC. So before discussing the Higgs boson, I would like to remind you briefly what happened over the last couple of years since DLHC started operation. As I mentioned before, it started at the end of 2009, but only in March 2010 it reached the present energy, or close to it. So it has been a very successful start, more than a start now, 2 years of operation, because the three important elements, the accelerator, the detectors, and the computers, have been working extremely well beyond the most optimistic expectation. We have been able to accomplish much more than expected in only 2 years. We experiments have recorded a huge amount of data thanks to the very good performance of the LHC, of the accelerator. And we have been able in 2 years to, in some sense, rediscover the standard model, so reobserve the particles that had been already discovered in the past. So no news, but it was nice to see them again and to measure them at a new energy, okay, at a higher energy. And also we have been exploring, looking for this physics beyond the standard model that could explain, answer at least part of the outstanding question. And we have not didn't find anything special for the time being, but of course it's very early. But we were able to rule out some of the theories that have been put on the market over the last years to address the questions I mentioned before. So clearly the most important accomplishment since the beginning of the LHC operation is the reported first observation by the two main experiments, ATLAS and CMS, of a particle which is very close in the features to the Higgs boson. I put the question mark because in research, in science, you have to be very careful. We have observed something, okay, new particle, but before we can state it's really the Higgs boson, we have to do more measurement, but it looks very much like it. And it has been observed at a mass of 125 GeV. To translate this in something more eatable, say, comestible, it's 125 times the proton mass, more or less. Okay, so why do we care and why this is important? So as I mentioned before, The discovery of the Higgs boson is a way of, allows us to explain how the elementary particles get a mass, because in the standard model, in this theory, all particles are massless, mass zero, like the photon, okay? And this is not what we observe. When we discover the various particles, we observe particles that are more massive, and they are not zero. They are more massive than the photon itself. And there is also a different, say, scale of masses from particle to particle. For instance, the top quark, which is the heaviest elementary particle ever discovered until now, which has a mass comparable with that of a gold atom, just to give you something, some idea, is much, much heavier than the electron, which is quite quite low weight, okay, quite slim. So the question is why first of all the different particles have different masses, and why this kind of pattern of masses that seems to be completely random. So this question may seem to be quite abstract. After all, who cares in our life if the elementary particles have masses and different masses? However, it's not, because if the masses of the elementary particles were not exactly what they are, and I say exactly what they are, then the world will not be as it is. The size of the atom will not be the same as it is. Second, the proton could decay because the neutron could be lighter. If the proton decays, there is no chemistry, there is no atom, there is no element like we know it. So perhaps the universe will be there, but it will be a completely different universe, and we will be completely different. So we should care about it. This is a very important question. Okay. So in the theory, in the standard model, at some point, a very clever physicist, Mr. Peter Higgs, a Scottish physicist, introduced a mechanism called Higgs mechanism, which allows the various particles to get a mass. Okay. The problem is that this Higgs mechanism predicted the existence of a new particle very different from all the other particles that we know, which is called Higgs boson. And the little problem with this Higgs boson is that it has been hunted for more than 20 years at all accelerators all over the world. Absolutely no hint for its existence, okay? And so clearly the excitement is now very high, because we have observed it last week at the LHC. We think we have observed something which is very similar to the Higgs boson. We don't know yet if it is the Higgs boson, the so-called standard Higgs boson predicted by Professor Higgs, or something more exotic but having a similar function, but we have found something which is very similar to what we expect. So what did we see? I cannot go into many details because I will become a bit too boring or too complex. But this is an example of what we see. So for instance, this is a schematic view. I need to get this point. A schematic view of the CMS detector. You can imagine one beam, one proton beam coming from this detector and the other one from this detector. They collide here in the middle. Okay, and you see the huge amount of particles that are produced in this collision. And out of this particle, you can see here two photons. Okay, you cannot say that they are photons. I tell you, you have to trust me. So these are two photons. And these two photons could be due to the production of X. Because if you take now all the events that contains two photons and you look at their mass, the mass of the particles that have produced these two photons, you see something smooth like that, and then you see here, a little peak. And this peak on top of a smooth thing indicates the production of a particle. Okay? So this is one example. This is CMS, but also our experiment ATLAS has observed something, not only in final state with photon, but the Higgs boson can also decay into four electrons. Electrons as photons are particles that are common in our life. They are either the quantum particles of the light or are part of the electricity. So in this event recorded by ATLAS, there is some particle or couple of particles that have produced four electrons shown here in the detector, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Okay. And if you look at all the events of this type, again, we see a little peak here, which indicates the production of something, of a heavy object decaying into four electrons. So, is this new particle the Higgs boson? As I said before, it resembles to it very much. We think it's the Higgs boson, but it's too early to tell in detail. Also, if it is exactly the Higgs boson predicted by Peter Higgs or something more exotic, so we will need to measure its properties in great detail in the months to come to understand how it behaves and to understand the main properties of this particle. Even if this is the Higgs boson, this is just the beginning of a long path because these particles raises many other questions. As always in research, you make a little step forward, you discover something, you answer a question, at least partially, but then that opens many other questions. Will it change our day-by-day life? Will your life change tomorrow? And the answer is yes and no. So tomorrow your life will not change. I guess your life didn't change. So the announcement of the observation of the Higgs boson was made on Wednesday last week. I don't think that your life changed on Thursday compared to what, based on what we announced on Wednesday. But it's also true that it's very difficult to predict what a fundamental discovery like this one, which is a very important step forward in understanding of in knowledge and fundamental knowledge and understanding of fundamental physics may entail. The practical implication of the Higgs bosons are not easy to predict, but for sure, every time you make a step forward in fundamental knowledge, sooner or later, the benefit for mankind and for the day-by-day life will show up. For instance, when Mr. Thompson, J.J. Thompson, observed for the first time an electron beam in the 19th century, of course, he could not imagine the importance of what he had discovered, the electron. And of course, I guess his neighbors were not particularly impressed by his discovery. But now, of course, we could not live without electricity. So sooner or later, a step forward in fundamental knowledge always entail progress. But there is another reason why the Higgs boson changes our life. It actually has already changed our life. And the reason is that in order to discover the Higgs boson and hopefully many other particles in the future, we had to develop high-tech instruments like the LHC accelerator, like the experiments, ATLAS and CMS, developing cutting-edge technology, technologies that at the time when we started to develop these magnets or these materials or these detectors were not completely mastered, not even by the most advanced industries, and we had to develop prototypes at CERN and then export them to industry. And so we have been leading in several fields the technology and the developments, but also these instruments found applications in other domains. So for instance, accelerators, we have today 30,000 accelerators in the world, and more than half of them are used for medical applications. So for instance, for hydrotherapy to treat cancers. Okay, and of course the techniques have been developed by us in general term, particle physicists and accelerator physicists at CERN and other laboratories all over the world, in the US, in Russia, in Europe, etc. So this is an example of a direct applications of the Higgs boson, if you want. Okay. The other example is instrumentation. We have built these detectors that I mentioned before, and these techniques are now being used also for instance, for medical imaging. I mentioned the World Wide Web, which is another spin-off of particle physics to society and to the everyday life. So when people ask you, will the Higgs boson change your life, you should answer, actually, yes. Okay, okay, so I'm coming to the conclusion. So at CERN, and in particular with the LHC, which is now the most advanced machine and accelerator in our field, we are addressing fundamental question about the elementary particles and, of course, also about the structure and evolution of the universe. And to do so, we advance the frontiers of technology also to the benefit of society. We have two other important missions, to train young people, so students, but also tomorrow's scientists, and to bring nations together through science. And with the LHC, a new era of discovery has started. I hope that the exposition is just the first step. I'm sure it's the first step. And it's clearly a very important step forward in fundamental science. I would like to remind two things. So we have discussed about possible implication on the practical life of these discoveries. However, I would like to stress that knowledge and science, research, a bit like art, these are essentially duties and rights and needs of the human beings as clever beings, okay? And I would like to mention an Italian poet of the 13th century. I know that there is a big Italian colony in Australia, in Melbourne in particular, Dante Alighieri. He said, fatti non foste a vivere come bruti, ma per seguire virtute e conoscenza. We were not born to live like animals, like brute, but to pursue virtue and knowledge. So research, knowledge, art, all these aspects are all aspects of the human ingenuity, brain, etc., which distinguishes us from animals. And the other things, of course, is very good to discover the X boson, but we should remember that that research is a long and endless path. We have to remain modest and humble. What we know is a droplet, and what we don't know is an ocean, as Isaac Newton used to say. So the path is very long and essentially endless. Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Fabio. It was a fantastic talk. I'm sure there will be a few questions. Who wants to be the first? You go for it.
So I understand that to discover the new particle, you have to...
I understand that to discover the new particle, you had to accelerate things to extremely high energies. My question is, at more day-to-day energies, are there implications of the finding?
I didn't catch the second part of your question. So we had to go to high energy, yes?
Yep. So at lower energies, like more day-to-day energies that you might see in more common technology, are there ramifications for the finding? Are there implications?
For the energy that we have reached in terms of energy, you mean?
For lower energies, like more day-to-day energies.
You just said the implication of what we discover or what we are seeing to the day-to-day life, I think.
This is what you are saying?
Yes.
Well, so first of all, there is one aspect that I would like to mention, because from what you said in the first part of your question, that perhaps is I was not very, very clear. Actually, the X boson is not so heavy. Okay, it's the second heaviest particle. We have discovered the top quark. Now the X boson, if it has a mass of 125 GeV, is the second heaviest particle. But it's not that heavy for a machine like the LHC. So the reason why it was very difficult to find was not really the lack of energy. It's that it is a very rare process, and it is in some sense hidden by background coming from other processes that we know already. And so extracting this rare process from the, for the huge amount of other final state which resemble the X boson, but they are not due to the X boson, was very, very, very difficult. Implication for real life in terms of energy, you're talking about energy no, not that much. These energies are very small on a microscopic scale, as I was saying before. They are very, very high and huge on a microscopic scale, but on a macroscopic scale, they are at the level of a very small fraction of a joule, so they are not really big energies.
You second. Wait for the microphone.
To the mass of the electrons, come naturally out of the Standard Model, or is that also explained by the Higgs mechanism?
Yes, everything. All the masses are... Okay, sorry. You're right. Your question is very good. So, yes and no. So the Higgs mechanism by itself is responsible for giving masses to the particles that are responsible for the force carrier. So I have to go back to this slide here. So we know, we are aware of two types of particles, now three with the Higgs boson, okay? One type of particles are the so-called matter particles. This here, of which there are three families, and of which the first family is responsible for matter as we know it. So we are all made of these two quarks called up and down, as I was mentioning before. Up and down are the main constituents of the neutron and the proton, which are the main constituents of the nucleus, and electrons, okay? And then we have another type of particles called gauge bosons, which in the microscopic world are responsible for transmitting forces. So the photon, this object here, is responsible for transmitting the electromagnetic force. The gluon is responsible for transmitting the strong force, which keeps the neutrons and the protons in the nucleus. The W and Z bosons are responsible for transmitting the weak force, which is responsible for radioactive decays or the thermonuclear reactions in the sun. So the Higgs boson itself, strictly speaking, is responsible for giving mass to the W and Z boson, leaving the photon massless. Okay, so this is the strict task of the Higgs boson. Whereas giving masses to other particles, like the electron, as you mentioned, the top quark, where is it? Here, the tau lepton and many others, well, the Higgs mechanism is the first step, but it may not be the full story. Okay, it may require yet another step, more physics, more complicated. So the question is very good, thank you.
Thank you so much for beautiful lecture. Thank you, Professor David. Let me explain for you. My university universe, I am wondering about two things. One about the universe and one about the human brain. I wish we use brain and mind. I give you one beautiful and deep beyond this lecture. Let me explain for you. If your eye go by a speed of light, 3,000 kilometers in a second. Albert Einstein explained for us, no one and no particle can go by a speed of light. But I am sure a speed of light cannot go to a black hole. What we have many black holes, we have many Big Bang. Can you tell us, please, which particle in the universe go more than a speed of light, even reduce, not reduce a speed of light, but more than a speed of light. When you go a speed of light, by more than a speed of light, these are not light. What is it, this particle? Thank you.
Thank you for the very interesting question. She's very, very hard to answer. As far as I know, there is no particle that go faster than the speed of light. Sorry. At some point, some news about neutrinos going faster than the speed of light came up, but then after some time they were abandoned. So as far as I know, there is nothing that goes faster than the speed of light. But perhaps we can have a discussion afterwards, and you will tell me in more details what you think. Thank you.
Anybody else on the other side? Just we over there. Right here. We got 1, 2, 3, and 4. Go over there, Amelia.
Fabiola, first, thanks a lot for coming to talk to us. It's a tremendous privilege to have you here. I've been doing my best to follow the proceedings of the conference this week, and it seems to me like theories of supersymmetry are highlighting the limitations of the Large Hadron Collider. I wonder if you could comment on how you feel about these theories and perhaps elaborate on possible future machines?
So, I think that is the other way around, is that the Large Hadron Collider is showing the limitation of supersymmetry rather than I have the impression, but no. So, okay, going to more serious, to a more serious light. It's an excellent question. The problem is that our discipline at the moment is really in a moment where we are thinking on how to continue and how to go on. Clearly, as I mentioned, the discovery of the Higgs boson is not the end, it's just the beginning. We will have to see how well we can measure it with the LHC. We have to see if we need another machine, more precise machine, to measure the parameters of the Higgs boson, like a linear collider, which can achieve much higher precision at the level of percent in the couplings of the Higgs boson. In 2 years from now, the LHC will go to higher energy, double the energy, almost. So until now, we have no evidence of other new physics beyond the standard model. I consider the Higgs boson for the moment as part of the standard model, even if the Higgs boson we have observed may not be standard. Okay, but let's assume it is standard. And we go to higher energy, and we may discover new physics. This new physics will tell us what kind of next machine we should build. Could be a linear collider, could be a higher energy proton machine. It's very difficult to say today. I think we need another machine in the future, but it's not really clear at this moment in time which one. And just to demonstrate that it's not an easy question, I will tell you that there is in place now a full group of very clever, wise people who are preparing, developing a strategy for the future of our discipline. And there will be a first meeting in September in Krakow. Then there will be a conclusion of this thinking toward the beginning of spring next year to try and see where to go. But it's not really really obvious, because clearly the Higgs boson on one end gives us some hints of something interesting to pursue, but at the same time doesn't give us all the answers and open new questions. So not clear. Sorry for being so vague, but I don't have the recipe today. We will have to think.
Okay, sorry, there was a question there and after there. So go there, Amelia.
Thank you for your explanations. Yeah, they are beautifully clear. Just a little side issue. I saw something to do with Google on one of the images there. Did they play a role in the computing or something like that?
Google.
Yeah, I saw Google down in the corner of one of your images.
Yeah, okay, so thanks for the question, because it allows me to go back. No, it's not really Google, it's a Google map. So to go back to the computing, and the reason why I put this image, which is taken from Google, but Google has nothing to do with that, is that computing is another big challenge for the LHC, because the amount of data that the experiments have to write to storage is enormous, at the level of 10 petabyte per year. 10 petabyte is 1 billion. One petabyte is 1 billion. 1 million gigabyte. But also, not only the amount of data is huge, but also these events are quite complicated, with hundreds and some thousands of particle tracks. So they need a lot of CPU to be reconstructed. And third element, as I mentioned before, the experiments are executed, are made by physicists from all over the world. So it will be impossible for all these physicists to access computer resources located at a given place, like CERN or like University of Melbourne, etc. So you need a lot of computing resources in terms of storage, in terms of CPU, and these resources have to be distributed all over the world to allow everyone to participate in an effective way to the data analysis. And so the solution to this problem, when we started to, at the time of the construction of the LHC, is the grid. And the grid is a network of computer centers from all over the world that are linked by very, very powerful and fast network. And so this image shows actually There are around 150 such centers in 35 countries, and this image shows the lines of data transfers from site to site. I would like to mention that the grid is a very nice concept, because in principle, it doesn't work like that, but in principle, a student in Tokyo who is doing a thesis on Atlas can analyze data stored in France using CPU in Germany, okay? And without the individual knowing what is going on behind the scene, being fully transparent. I'm just behind my screen and I just send my job, and the grid itself master the data distribution, the access, and all these things. So the grid actually has been extremely successful. It's a new concept, and of course now is also applied to other disciplines, meteorology, financing, etc. But it was very, very important also from the social point of view, because it has allowed people from all over the world to participate in a very important way to the data analysis. And so people are located, for instance, the discovery of the Higgs has been made thanks to the work of many people, in particular young people. Some of them are at CERN, but some of them are on the other side of the globe, and they have Melbourne, for instance, and they've been working from home and participating in a very effective way to this important result.
Okay, so that is the last question over there. And after, I think, is the last one I take, because start getting late.
About the funding for this beautiful apparatus. We have a lot of trouble in Australia squeezing funding out of our government for scientific and medical research. We have a great struggle. I want to know what your secret is. How you got all these physicists to convince these European governments and other governments to put on the table so much money to develop such a beautiful machine? What's the secret? How can we achieve similar things here?
Well, so first of all, it's not easy for us either, also because it's a very difficult moment from the point of view of economy. So all countries have less and less money, and you know very well that the first thing people cut is research, because of course, in particular fundamental research, because applied research, at least in medical field, you can say, okay, fine, with this research I can treat people with cancer, and so of course I cannot cut it. But for particle physics, the Higgs boson, who cares? I cut it. And this is wrong. This is plain wrong, because of course it's at the moment where you are in a moment of crisis, you have to invest more and more on fundamental research, because it's fundamental research that bring progress. If you just cut on fundamental research, then at some point even the applied aspect of the research will suffer from it, because if you don't have the ideas behind, if you don't have the innovation behind, then at some point also, I mean, the applied research and also the economy at the end will suffer. So it becomes a kind of spiral, of terrible spiral. So I think that we try all over the world to give this message, and also we try to show people, as I was showing before, that this is true, this is fundamental research, but because it's so innovative, where is it? I cannot find my slide. It's so innovative that already brings a lot of spin-off and a lot of important consequences also for people's life, if you think about, for instance, the hadron therapy. But you know, more than that, it's very difficult to say. Let's hope that that people understand that there are that this is very. I mean, research is worth investing money rather than in other activities sometimes that are not really, how to say, so bright and so high level for human beings.
Okay, thanks. We had quite a few questions. I think there are still questions, but I think we are running out of time. You can ask the question later to the speaker. And I would like to thank again Fabiola. The talk was beautiful, and questions were answered very nicely, and I think all of the audience was inspired. So I would like to thank again the speaker, and
thank you.
That's it.